Good morning. We have seen yesterday that it's possible to describe a quantum system that is pre and post selected by two vectors instead of one. One of the vectors comes to the present from the past boundary condition, another vector comes back from the future boundary condition. And if we take this seriously, that means that such pre and post selection systems should have more properties than the usual one that we conclude from just one vector. And we looked at a special case of the pre and post selection being two different components of the spin, and we said maybe we should think about a particle like this as having both sigma x and sigma y definite if these are the two boundary conditions. And then I raised the question, what happens if we measure sigma x plus sigma y, will we get the value 2? And at first it looks impossible because the value 2 is beyond the usual range of eigenvalues. And then I suggested that the reason why we don't see both properties is because the measurement that we try to use in order to measure sigma x plus sigma y will disturb both vectors, exactly the properties that we want to see would be disturbed. And then I raised the idea that perhaps if we find a new kind of measurement that will interact only very weakly with the particles so that it wouldn't disturb either sigma x or sigma y, then there will be hope to see it. Of course, we have to repeat the experiment many times because a weak measurement wouldn't give us enough information in each individual case. And then I suggested that perhaps there is something interesting about reducing the strength of the measurement. And I suggested that if we collect in each such measurement very small information that I call epsilon. So and if epsilon is equal to 1 over n, we have to make n experiments on the same idea, similar systems in order to collect the information. And I was suggesting that as we will see, in that case, the disturbance when each measurement goes at epsilon square, and therefore, at the limit when n is large, we'll be able to find information without disturbing the system. And that is the new idea of weak measurements. And I wanted yesterday to show you how it worked, and then people told me that I must stop because the talk was ended already. So I will do it now. Okay. Suppose somebody prepares n non-interacting spins, all of them in the same direction. And the question is now, can we find in which direction they were all prepared? We are not told the direction. First of all, we know that it's possible in principle, because if we have all of them prepared in this direction or all of them prepared in that direction. If we have just a single spin, of course, we can't distinguish because the scalar product is not zero, and therefore there is no way to distinguish between a single spin prepared in this direction and a single spin prepared in that direction. But if we have enough of them, the scalar product of this whole ensemble is a vector, with the scalar product of this will go as cosine theta to the power n. If n is sufficiently large, these are two orthogonal vectors in the Hilbert space of this whole system, and therefore, in principle, it should be possible to find out by looking at this large collection in which direction they were prepared. But the question is now, how are we going to do it? The usual approach would be the following. We select a subgroup of them, measure from this subgroup sigma x, and from that, we find sometimes plus, sometimes minus. We can calculate in this way the average of sigma x if we have enough of them. Then we take another subgroup and measure sigma y for each one of them, and find in this way sigma y average, and that finally we'll be able to tell the direction. But these are all experiments that are destructive, because the experiments that we use on each particle doesn't leave its state unchanged, it makes collapses. So I want now to show that it's possible to do a different experiment to find out this direction without disturbing even a single speed. That will be the justification by saying that I said before that I can collect information by what happens to each one of them without disturbing the method. So here is the way that it works. I first want to prove a very interesting theorem, which I'm always surprised that I never see it in any quantum book. If I have any vector in Hilbert space and any observable, any Hermitian operator, I can always write that as the sum of A1 times psi plus A2 times some orthogonal state of psi. This is obvious geometrically. This time that gives me a new vector. I can take this new vector, find the part of it that is parallel to this one, and what is left is orthogonal. And the question is now, what are A1 and A2? And there is something amazing that happens here, because A1 turns out to be the average of A in the state psi, and A2 turns out to be the uncertainty of A in the state psi. And that's amazing, because we are discussing now a property just of a single particle. And nevertheless, the coefficient here seem to be connected with what we usually think are properties only of a large collection. Let me prove it to you, because it's such an important theorem, and it can be used later, as I will show if I will have time tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, that from just from this one alone, I will be able to deduce the Born rule without any assumption apart from just the dynamics of this measurement. Let me prove that this is true. If I take A psi and multiply it by psi, this is what we call A average. If I do it on this side, I multiply by psi here, I just pick A1, because this will not contribute since psi times psi orthogonal is zero. So from this I deduce that A, that psi psi is equal to A1. I have proven that one. Now, how do I write this? Ah, this way. Okay. The other way. Thank you. And I want to, if I take A psi and multiply it by itself, this is equal to psi times A square psi, because I can take this A summation operator and bring it here. And if I look on the other side, I see that this is equal, if I take to A1 square plus A2 square. If I multiply this by itself, I don't get any cross product, so I get that the square of this that is normalized, so give me A1, and the square of this give me A2. And by the way, I can always make A2 real by redefining the phase of psi orthogonal. So I see, therefore, that A2 square is equal to the square, to the average of the square, this is the average of the square, minus A1 square, which is minus the square of the average. So this is indeed equal to the uncertainty of A square. So, I repeat that this is a very, very interesting, interesting new property of Hilbert space. You just have arbitrary operator, an arbitrary vector, and just for this single vector, from its geometrical properties, you see some things that we usually associate only with probabilities for the whole ensemble. So this is very deep. Now, I'm going to use this theorem now in order to prove the limit that I'm talking about with measurement. So suppose I have an ensemble where I have n particles, n goes from one to n. I have a product of n particles, all of them described in the same state. Sorry. And I look now at the operator, the sum of a n divided by n. It's an operator that acts on the whole ensemble. So I want to find out if I call this psi total of the ensemble. I want to find out what happens when I apply this operator to psi total. So let's see what happens when I take just one of them and apply to psi total. So let me look at AM and apply to psi total. AM will interact only with the vector that corresponds to the system M here. And when it acts on the system M, I'm using this form, this result that I showed there. So this will be, first of all, a average, the individual average, for which is the same for all of them, the individual average for one of them, times the same psi total, because that part doesn't change the vector. So it leaves the psi total the same. And then there is an extra correction, which is delta A times psi total orthogonal. And the orthogonal state here depends on M. So I have to give it an index delta A times psi total M, where psi total M is taking the original ensemble, changing only the vector for the nth particle to an orthogonal state. So now if I look at the sum of AM divided by N times psi total, I see first of all A average times psi total. Why A average? Because each one of them gave me the average divided by N, but I have the sum of all N of them that give me A average times psi total plus delta psi. And I want to prove that the size of delta psi goes to zero when N is sufficiently large, as the limit by N goes to infinity. So what is delta psi? Delta psi is equal to delta A over N times the sum of what I call psi total N. The important thing is each one of those are orthogonal to the other one, because when I look at one of them, I change the nth particle to the orthogonal state. Another one, I change another particle to the orthogonal state. So these are all orthogonal vectors to each other. Therefore, if I calculate delta psi times delta psi, I get delta A squared, which is finite, divided by N squared times N, because the square of that is equal to N since they are orthogonal to each other, right? So therefore this goes to zero when N goes to infinity, because I have seen 1 over N here. So I found, therefore, a very important theorem that if I do a measurement that interacts very weakly with each one of the particles there, because I look at the sum of AN divided by N. If I measure that, the interaction with each individual particle goes to zero when it's very large, but the interaction with the sum will give me the result of A average. And if the limit to N goes to infinity, it will give me a definite result. So the ensemble, if N is sufficiently large, behaves like an eigenvector of the sum of AN divided by N. So for example, if I look back on my set of spins, I will now make a measurement of the sum of sigma x divided by n, and we find that sigma x average without changing even a single one of them, because I left the ensemble unaffected, as the limit of n is very large. So I can now find that I can measure every property of individual particles without changing any of the particles, provided I have enough of them. This is a kind of protection by big numbers. So I can, for example, suppose I look at the Schrödinger wave psi each for each particle. I want now to see, can I find psi of x if I have enough particles that are all of them described by the same state without at all making any collapse? And the answer is yes, because I can take a measure, for example, I can take the projection operators, the sum of the projection operators at a given position x for all the particles, and divide it by n, make a weak measurement of that without changing any of the particles, I will find the average of the projection operator, which is psi sub psi at this position. And I can do this experiment as many times as I like, as long as n is sufficiently large. And therefore, I can find all the properties of individual particles if I have enough replicas without at all making any collapse at all, without making any collapse. This is a new idea that it's possible to find all information about quantum systems provided they have enough replicas without doing any collapse at all. But now I want to show even something more interesting. If I look at the A average for an individual particle, this is equal to psi A psi. And I know that I can measure this exactly if I have enough particles that are all of them described as the same state. Now I can rewrite this formula by putting here a complete set of eigenvectors for any operator. This is a unit operator which I can stick here. So I can put this and then multiply by A times psi. And this sum gives me still A average. Right? I just put here a unit operator, so I'm allowed to do that. Now I can rewrite this as psi times phi n and multiply by phi n times psi and have this thing phi n a psi, and I have to divide by that thing because I multiply by, so I divide here. And now I see something amazing. Because I make weak measurements, I know that I did not change psi for any particle. So this describes the probability to start with a number of particles that all of them are described by psi and pick up the sub-ensemble of phi, that the post-selection will be phi n. This thing is the probability to find how many times, the probability to find the pre and post-selection psi and phi n. And I find that the same result, A average, can be thought now about the taking the whole ensemble, doing pre and post selection, and get that value each time when I look at an individual pre and post selection. This is the quantity that I named weak value. So the weak value of A, given pre and post selection, is equal to phi A psi divided by phi psi. This suggests that if I do very weak coupling to any system, any quantum system that is pre and post selected, the result of the measurement of this weak coupling will be a shift in the pointer by this new quantity, which is the weak value. That shifts, if I look at the pointer, that has some uncertainty. And this pointer now interacts with the particle that is pre and post selected. It will be shifted by a very small amount compared to the uncertainty, because the interaction is very weak. But the shift the small amount, the small shift will be proportional not to one of the eigenvalues, but to this new quantity, which is the weak value. I repeat this experiment many times and collect only the answers for the cases where I had the same PM postulation. Then I could, by collecting enough of them, I could find out what was this shift. And I find out that I can do a measurement on PM postulation quantum systems. If I have an ensemble of PM postulation, I will get a shift that I could see robustly, and that shift will be proportional to the weak value, or instead I can do with each individual particle, I can use another pointer, then collect the results only for those cases that I got the same pre and post selection, and I will get a result that is exactly equal to the weak value. So now we are in business, because we can come back to the original problem that was the motivation for this. Remember, I have sigma is equal to 1 at the beginning, sigma y equal to 1 at the end, and I interact weakly with sigma x plus sigma y. Then I take a measurement device that measures sigma x and sigma y very, very weakly. Then I know that the answer for this will be the weak value of this quantity. So let's see what is the weak value in that case. I have an initial state sigma x equals to 1. I have a final state sigma y equals to 1. In the middle, I put sigma x plus sigma y. And I have to divide by the scalar product of sigma y equals to 1 times sigma x equals to 1. That is the weak value of sigma x plus sigma y. And that's what I will get each time I will have a very weak interaction between the measuring device and the particle that's PM post selected this way. I collect enough weak shifts I get, and I will get this value. Now, this value is indeed equal to 2. Why? Because the sigma x, x from d give me 1 times the product. This give me, x from d give me also 1. So this indeed will be the answer 2. So that shows that we can begin to give a new meaning to properties of quantum systems that are PM post-selected if we are doing very careful experiments that don't disturb them at all. Then we'll find that these quantum systems are described indeed by two properties, one dictated by the vector coming from the past, and the other dictated by the vector coming back from the future. Okay, now I want to show how I can use this new way of looking to find what happens in interference when I do pre and post selection to quantum systems. And I can do the following. I can suppose I have two slits. I can, first of all, prepare the particle in most in the Schrödinger presentation, say that we have a amplitude that goes through both slits. I do in the middle experiment to find the interference pattern only by weak measurement, so I don't disturb the particle that comes from the past. And then on each one of these particles, I do a post selection that tells me through which slit the particle went. And then I will be able now to see an interference pattern for particles that I know exactly each one of them through which slit it went. And I will get now a new way to think about interference patterns that has nothing to do with wave properties, because I don't need situations where the particle goes through both slits. Each particle will go only through one slit, and I know through which slit it goes. Let me show you how it works. We take a concrete example, and this will show a new way to think about interference using the Heisenberg picture, and not the Schrödinger one. So let's take a very simple example. I will do just a one-dimensional problem. I start initially with a superposition of two states that are a distance L apart. This is psi 1, and this is psi 2. And I write psi 1 to be equal to e to the minus x plus l. Let's call the distance 2l. X plus l squared over delta x squared times e to the I k zero x, where k zero is very, very large compared to 1 over delta x. So if this is a wave packet that is shifted, Gaussian shifted the distance l here, and it has the average velocity, which is h bar k zero divided by m, which is very large compared to the uncertainty. So I know that this wave packet will move to the center without appreciable spread at all. So I can neglect the spread. And this one, psi 2, is equal to e to the minus x minus l squared over delta x squared, 2 delta x squared, times e to the minus I k0 x. So if I raise the time l divided by v average, the average velocity, both of them will meet at the center, and I will then see the usual, the right interference pattern, because after that time, I will see that it will be e to the minus x squared over 2 delta x squared multiplied by cosine k0 x. Because the one that comes from the left gives me e to the I k0 x, and the one coming from the right e to the minus I k0 x. So I see indeed the interference pattern, because the probability will be cosine squared k0. So I will see when they meet, that this will be the envelope, and I will see a nice interference pattern that depends on the relative phase between the two. If I change the relative phase, that pattern will be shifted. The maximum and minima will be shifted by being equal to cosine kx plus so x0, well, that depends on the relative phase. Okay, so I want now to see if I can describe this by pre and post reaction in the following way. Suppose when the two of them meet and I have an ensemble, I can do a weak measurement to find this interference pattern. Maybe I take each one of these particles and measure the average of projection operator very, very weakly. I do it very weakly. I have to collect information for many particles, but the important thing is that measurement does not change the wave function of each one of them. And that means that because I did not change the wave function of each one of them, I can then wait. Here's the story. I start initially this moving this way, this moving this way. That's the time t0. Here's the story as a function of time. At time t0, I have this one moving this way and this one moving this way. At time t1, they met in the middle and I saw interference pattern, but I measured this interference pattern by weak measurement. That means that I have to collect many, many experiments until I see it. And the important thing is I have not changed the wave function of any one of them. So at time t2, this one will move this way, and this one will move that way. They are separated again. And because I did not affect any wave function, I can now look at each one of them, whether it's moving this way or moving that way. So by pre and post selection, the pre selection tells me that I started in this state. The post selection tells me whether it was moving this way or that way. That means that I can now tell both the fact that there is interference pattern and also the information for each one of them, whether it came from this side or it came from that side. So that's like having information both on which street the particle went through and that it has interference. Now, I can describe this thing in two different languages, the Heisenberg language and the Schrödinger language. In the Schrödinger language, I say something like this. I have two vectors. The vector coming from the past, this is the initial vector, tells me that the particle is in both locations. The vector coming back from the future tells me that the particle is in one location. So these are very strange languages. At the same time, I say I know for sure that the passing is coming from the right, say, and at the same time, I must say in the Schrodinger representation, the passing is also in both locations at the same time. You see, this is a very strange language. I have to say, at the same time, I'm sure about the particle that is moving both ways, and at the same time, I'm sure about the particle that is moving one way. This is very unsatisfactory language. Now, I show you there is another language, it's the Heisenberg language, that tells me that indeed each particle moves only on one side, but it has another property, as I will show you now, which is connected with the modular momentum, and that property tells you what interference you are going to have. So this will be a much better language. The language here will be not that the particle must be at different locations. It is only one location, but it has another property which tells you what later will be the interference. So let's see how the Heisenberg representation works here. This is really very nice. I have here the initial wave function going this way and that way. Now, let me look at the operator e to the I, p, x, times 2l, plus 2k0 times x. This operator takes this function from here to here, and this thing changes the k0 by 2k0, so it changes, for example, 2k0, k0 to minus k0. So this is the operator whose average now is equal to 1/2, and this average tells me that indeed this particle was had this non-local property. What happened to this non-local property as a function of time? Because in the Heisenberg picture now, I am saying I'm not going to move the waves at all. This is just an initial condition. I'm not doing to this initial condition anything. I'm instead looking at properties of the operators and let them change as a function of time. What happens as a function of time to the operator x? The operator x goes to x. I will have it, by the way, a sign minus. So the operator x goes to x plus p over mt. And t is equal to L over V average. So X will go to X plus P over M times L over V average. And V average is P average divided by M. So the M cancels and I get here X plus P L over P average. So if I look at that thing, I claim that after the right period t, p goes into p, x goes to this x, and I will find that this operator becomes just the operator e to the I 2k0x. So the original information translates itself at a later time by the time evolution of the operator to information that the average of this operator is now large. And the average of this operator being large exactly tells me that the pattern is such, because this pattern, which is proportional to cosine squared k0x, this is 1 plus cosine 2k0x, and if I take the average of this with this quantity, I get a large number. So I'm claiming now that I can just start with the original wave and ask what properties does this wave have. It has one property which tells me that it's either here or here. That property in time goes to this one, but if I look at the projection operator, this projection operator goes to here, this projection goes to here, so I keep this wave uncanned, but I say what happened to the deterministic operator tells me that I have either this projection operator or that one. That information tells me that it goes to the middle. There is another Heisenberg information, which is the average of this operator, The distance time becomes the average just of a local operator, which tells me that there must have an interference pattern. So in the Heisenberg picture, I can then say that if, for example, I can look at something very dramatic, suppose I discuss a very rare pre-imposed selection ensemble. And then something very amazing happened. From the post-selection, I see that all the particles in this rare pre-imposed example are moving this way. So from the pre-imposed selection, I will have a picture where I have some particles just moving this way. At some intermediate time here, I will suddenly see an interference pattern, and I can measure it quickly, and then they all go like this together. This will be something that I can measure weekly on the pre-imposed selection ensemble. Now I find another interesting thing, that if while all the particles are moving here, I put some potential on this side, that interference pattern will change. So I have now an amazing situation. I have n particles that because they are pre and post selected, they all move from the right towards the center. At first there is just a Gaussian without any local information. By the time it arrives at the center, suddenly I see a whole interference pattern appearing. Then it moves further, and the interference pattern disappears. And if I repeat this experiment with the same pre and post selection, while all the particles are moving here, I put a potential on the empty space where there's no particles at all, I will find that the interference pattern in the middle has changed. That means that something in these particles, where they're moving from the right, there was some other property that they had that was affected by potential that I put at a place where no particle was there. So this is indeed the way to see that the correct description is to of such particles is to describe them by in the Heisenberg picture by saying they can be all moving from one side, and the interference pattern that will appear here was because each one of them has another property, which is the modulo variable that I described there. And that modulo variable has no local equation of motion, and therefore it can be affected by what I do on the other side. That it has no local equation of motion, I will show you tomorrow, but I don't have enough time now. I will stop now and let you ask some questions about this. I hope that you are able to follow it, because it's not so simple when you hear it first time. But if you think carefully what I said, you will see that this is a new picture that is much better than sharing a picture, because in the sharing picture, the only way I could explain it is by saying that at the same time that each particle was in both locations and only in this location. And this is very, very unsatisfactory language. It's much better to say, as Heisenberg said, I would have said that each particle is moving just on one side, but it has at the same time another property, which is a non-local modulo variable, and this property has no local equations of motion. Let me tell you one interesting historical fact that you will find amazing. In 1962, most of you were not alive then, but in 1962, I visited Max Planck Institute. It was 2 years after I finished my PhD, and people introduced me to Heisenberg, that was still alive at that time, so I came to his office, and we talked for a while, and then I asked him, Professor Heisenberg, do you know how to describe what happened in two series experiments using your language and not the Schrödinger language? And he spoke for me and said, no, I don't know how to do it. So I showed him this language of the modulo variable with the non-local interaction. He got very excited, and then his assistant, Peter Duhr, said later that each visitor that would come to him, the first thing he would show on the blackboard would be how to describe interference pattern using his representation. You see, Heisenberg was very unhappy at the beginning time when he developed his theory and then Schrödinger came. Everybody left Heisenberg, went to Schrödinger, and Heisenberg was saying all the time, this is not the right physics. The right physics is what I'm saying, what Schrödinger said. It cannot be the right physics, because what is this wave that's moving there? But nobody listened to him, because it was so nice to do calculations using the Schrödinger picture, and you can have very nice images, what it is, but the image was about the mathematics, not about the physics. And now, we see that Heisenberg was right. The correct description should be not by the Schrödinger picture. The Schrödinger picture we should think about only as a mathematical way to calculate what happened to vector in Hilbert space. But the physical properties of this vector is described by Heisenberg and not by Schrödinger. Schrödinger will say that the party is the same time in many different locations. Nobody can check it. Nobody can understand what it is. Heisenberg will say, no, the particles, as we have seen here, we can always find by postulation where the particle is, and the reason why it has interference is not because it is at the same time in two different locations, but because there is a non-local property together with the knowledge about the position. This non-local property knows if the other field is open or closed, or knows if there is some potential that we put next to the other field. So this is a much better language, and I think if we learn to think in this language, and I will show you in many two lectures beautiful things that we can do with it, we learn to develop a real intuition about quantum systems that doesn't depend on this crazy idea that a single quantum particle that has charged the mass somehow spreads in space. We understand what it means unless we speak about probability. But when we speak about amplitude, we don't know what it means. What does it mean to have amplitude of a quantity like mass and charge that we always find them just in one location? So what is this amplitude? So Heisenberg says this amplitude is in fact nothing more than the average properties of non-local variables that can sit together with the particle being in a well-defined location. I will explain this more tomorrow how this works. I will show in fact that we can always interpret psi of x at each location as the average of another modulo variable. So there is a physical way to understand this picture without having to say at the same time the particle in many different locations. This is a crazy idea, and it's just because of that language nobody could develop intuition about something that nobody can understand. Because we can't understand what does it mean for a particle that we always find in just all its mass and charge in one location, but when we don't look, it somehow managed to be in many different locations. This is crazy. Okay, if there are any questions, I will entertain. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Yeah, if you start this particle superposition like this,
yeah,
and find it in the same superposition, how will they come back? So you find it in both places.
I don't find both. Then
you are ready to tell that the particle was in two places?
No. No, because I don't understand what it means. I would say that I have a vector in Hilbert space, a vector in Hilbert space, that when I expand it in position representation, I see that thing, but really the properties of this vector are given by averages of modular momentum and not by saying that it's the same place. Wait with this question till tomorrow, because tomorrow I'm going to show how for any situation I can replace the old information of psi of x by information about averages of modular variables. And these are the things that are physical, okay? So to say that because I expand the vector Hilbert space in position representation, I have amplitude, and suddenly I say this amplitude has physical meaning. No, what the physical meaning is the vector, and the question is what physical properties does this vector have? The only amplitude, the only connection with psi of x can be connected with probability to find them, but not with saying that something is there at the same time in two different locations. You have a question?
Here, the formula on top.
Which one?
The A side.
Yeah.
Do you know that people in the literature are now referring to that as the Bateman formula?
The what?
The Bateman formula.
The Bateman formula?
The Bateman formula.
Which one?
And you know why?
Yeah.
Because you published it in a footnote. You published American Journal of Physics. People are referring to the American Journal of Physics.
They both published it in a footnote in 19,
yeah.
And definitely that it was
This formula is really great thing, but then many things come out of yeah. it, so...
No, but I
think there is something that is citation, and I don't think there is any...
No,
I
discovered the formula, so if they are referring to it's a Rhino formula, it's the wrong reference, yeah. Any other question? Okay, thank you. Yeah, you have a question?
What was the post-selection field?
The post-selection is how the party was going this way. The interesting was this past day, the post-selection, I found that the party was moving here. That's all. I just found it here, not here. That's all. That's the post-selection. Very simple.
Is there such a post-selection?
I don't understand. That's why you're talking so quietly, nobody knows what you're asking. What is the question?
That's